Why, during Advent season, the Christmas holiday, you are about to hear read to you the story of Cain and Abel, especially coming hot off the heels of a sermon on hell last week. Is it just that Brant and I are uniquely incompetent ministers in selecting Christmas texts? Well, when we proceed in Mark next week to divorce, you may be convinced that that is, in fact, the case. But there is a larger and more astute explanation as well, and it's twofold. First is our firmly held belief in this church that the entire Bible is fundamentally about Jesus. And therefore, we don't have to stop preaching about Jeremiah or the end of Mark or something like that to focus on the manger and on the birth of Jesus, because we firmly believe that every page of the Bible points either forward or reflects backwards on Emmanuel, God for us. And so that is one conviction. The second, and why I explain specifically Cain and Abel, and we're sticking with Genesis here, is not only during this Advent season do we remind ourselves that once Israel longed for the Savior to come, for God to come in flesh, but by imaginatively identifying with Israel and her longing, it also shapes us and trains our longings. Because we too, though Jesus has come, and we affirm that, we look forward to the day when he will come again. And so as we sing, or just sang in O Come, Emmanuel, we are still looking forward to that desire of nations to bind in one the hearts of all mankind, to bid our sad divisions cease and be our King of peace. And so while we do affirm that God has come in the man Jesus, we also affirm that many things in this world are not right. They are not as they should be. And so that is why paying attention to this longing that we're going to see in Genesis 4 is beneficial for us as well during this Advent season. A brief explanation, especially since we have visitors with us today. I am about to pray and ask that we would be astute and that our longings would be shaped as we reflect on this Old Testament passage, and that it would point us forward to Jesus. Then we will read together after prayer Genesis chapter 4. After that, I will declare that this is God's word, to which you will respond, thanks be to God, and we will rise to our feet and sing together a short hymn, the Gloria Patri, that the church has sung together for thousands of years now, to acknowledge that this is God's word to us. It is his testimony to his son to us. That being said, let us turn now to prayer. Father, seeing your son in each page of the Bible is not a magic trick or some illusion that we perform. It is rather something that happens as our desires are trained by your Spirit at work within us, as our eyes are opened and we are attuned to your word. And so we ask that all of that would happen this morning, or afternoon rather, that as we read together Genesis 4, as we reflect on this passage, that it would not simply be a passage about two brothers long ago, but rather it would speak to us the truth of your son, and it would be a living testimony to us. We ask these things by the power of your Son, who is our mediator, and through the Holy Spirit. Amen. Let us read now Genesis chapter 4. Now, Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought an offering of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. And the Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Cain then spoke to his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, Where is Abel, your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to your strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. When he built a city, he called the name of that city after the name of his son, Enoch. To Enoch was born Arad, and Arad fathered Mahuahel, and Mahuahel fathered Methushael, and Methushael fathered Lamech, and Lamech took two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the other Zillah. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwelt in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. Zillah bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, "Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, "God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him." To Seth also was born a son, and he called his name Enosh. At that time, the people began to call upon the name of the Lord. This is God's word. Well, the story we have before us this morning is full of difficulty. It's full of questions. Why does God prefer Abel and his offering to Cain and his offering? How did they know which offering God even preferred? What does Cain say to Abel to lure him out to the field? What is the mark that Cain receives? Furthermore, there's various difficult Hebrew passages, as we'll see. When Eve declares, "I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord," and when God later says to Cain, "Will you not be accepted?" These are among two of the most difficult to translate sentences in the whole book of Genesis. And the Hebrew at these points is not simply difficult because of obscure words, but they're intractably open to multiple construals. In fact, the Septuagint, that Greek translation of the Bible made about 250 BC, resolves much of the ambiguity of the narrative, but as a result almost tells a different story than the Hebrew. It specifies that God rejects Cain's sacrifice for wrongly dividing the sacrifice, and it supplies specific words. Cain says, "Let us go to the field." So it has long been recognized, at least since 250 BC, that we have a variety, or in various ways, the story is open to multiple construals, and so it's not necessarily clear exactly what we should make of it. It seems to me, though, that the theme of the text this morning asks us, or rather the text before us this morning, asks us to consider two themes. The first is providence, and the second is the theme of the growth of sin. The theme of providence is reflected in two ways. In the story of Cain and Abel, the fundamental question is how we should respond to providence, to those things that happen in our lives. And in the genealogy that follows the story of Cain and Abel, we see this ambiguous progress that each generation marks and this historical progression. And so we have to reflect on how is providence guiding that progress. The second theme, the growth of sin, you might think that it should be more prominent in the story. After all, if we have a sort of simple Sunday school type schema of the Bible, we would think Genesis 1 and 2 is about creation, Genesis 3 is the fall, and therefore Genesis 4 should immediately be about original sin or something along those lines, right? And then there's a bunch of fuzzy bits, and then the flood comes after a few chapters. On this sort of schema, then, shouldn't we expect Genesis 4 to begin with some sort of a note about original sin or the sinfulness of humanity? Perhaps on the model of Psalm 51:5, where David says that he was brought forth in iniquity, we would expect to read in Genesis 4:1 that Eve conceived a son in iniquity and brought forth him in sin, or something like that. And yet that's not what we receive. We don't find any technical theological terminology about innate sin or original sin here. But after all, this is a narrative, so maybe we shouldn't be expecting systematic theology categories. If we do attend carefully to the narrative structure, we see, in fact, that this theme of the growth of sin is prominent throughout these chapters. Genesis 3 through 11, after the accounts of creation, which we have reflected on in previous weeks, is divided into four main episodes separated by these various genealogies. The first episode is Adam and Eve and eating the fruit, which we've looked at two previous weeks. The episode before us now is about Cain and Abel and them offering these sacrifices to God. The next major narrative episode is the flood. And finally, the final narrative episode of this early part of Genesis is the story about people building this tower in the area of Babel. Now, not only are there four episodes, but these four episodes are structured in generally parallel fashion. They each begin or feature prominently a divine command. In response to that divine command, humans actually rebel instead of obeying. As a result, then, there comes a divine judgment. But in each instance, there's a mitigation of the divine judgment. There's grace and forbearance in the context of judgment. So thinking about these narratives, God told Adam and Eve, don't eat the fruit from this certain tree, the tree of knowledge of good and bad. That's the divine command. The human rebellion is they go ahead and eat the fruit anyways instead of following the command. The judgment is that they are sent out from the garden, but remember there's this mitigation or this grace that God clothes them before he sends them out. Here we see the command, God tells Cain, if you do well, it will go well with you, i.e. don't murder your brother, and yet Cain goes ahead and kills his brother anyways. Then we see this divine judgment, and yet this mark of Cain is a grace or forbearance in this circumstance, that it's his promise that he will not be murdered. Looking ahead in the flood, there's not an explicit divine command, but we're generally meant to read it against the background of common grace, that people are not meant to do violence to each other, and yet every thought of man's heart is wickedness, and the earth is filled with violence, is what we read. And so the punishment is this flood that comes, and yet again, there's this forbearance. There's the Noah and his family and all the animals being preserved on the ark. Finally, just to finish out the series, in the Tower of Babel, they are told to spread out and fill the whole earth. And instead they say, come, let us build a tower together, lest we be spread abroad. So they explicitly say, let's do the opposite thing. The judgment is that the languages, they're given various languages. The interesting thing is when you finish chapter 11, you think, well, where is the divine grace? What is the mitigation in that context? And chapter 11 ends by saying, Terah bore a son named Abram. And so that God picks this family, the family of Abraham, to work with is the way that grace works out from there. So if we pay attention to this broad structure, and sorry for the long aside here, but if we pay attention to this broad structure, what we see is this growth of sin throughout the earth. And so implicitly, we see that people are innately sinful following on chapter 3 of Genesis. In our exposition of the chapter before us today, then, we must attend to two parallel themes. On the one hand, divine providence, and on the other, a growth in human sinfulness. The text before us, chapter 4, the genre is a genealogy. It's basically a story of who this line, this family tree. It begins with Adam. It ends with, on the one hand, Cain's the descendants through Cain that culminate with Lamech. On the other hand, Adam, Seth, and Enosh. And so it's basically a genealogy, just like we find in Genesis chapter 5. But within this genealogy, there's two narrative expansions. We're told a story about Cain and his brother that is no more, and we're told about Lamech, the seventh son in the line of Cain from Adam. So it's basically a genealogy, and that does help us to know because it's very specific in what it's focused on. And so when we arrive at questions like who's going to kill Cain, well, it's outside the concern of the genealogy because it's tracing one line of descendants. It's not looking at, you know, who else is round about that might kill Cain. So it's a genealogy, and it begins as genealogies do by saying Adam knew his wife. She conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have now gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. So far, it's basically a genealogy. We don't get into the narrative proper yet. First, we should comment that the term know is a euphemism, of course, for intimate experiential knowledge of his spouse. But this euphemism is used not because of shyness about being explicit, but in order to connect with the themes of knowing that run throughout Genesis chapter 3 and 4. The temptation in Genesis 3 is to eat this fruit that's going to give knowledge, supposedly. Throughout the rest of this chapter, there's repeated references to people knowing their wives. And when God asks Cain, where's your brother? He says, I do not know. So there's this prominent theme that runs throughout of right and wrong knowing. Interestingly, in these first two verses, only one conception is reported, and yet two births. Since 4:17 explicitly reports that Cain knew his wife and she conceived, and again 4:25 says Adam knew Eve again and she conceived, each time a birth is preceded by a note about a conception, a logical inference to draw is that Cain and Abel were twins. There's only one conception and yet two births. This has been a long-standing interpretive tradition going back to the rabbis, and it's prominent in Luther and Calvin and throughout. It's sort of an imaginative engagement with the text. And I think not wrongly. I think it's a right imaginative construal of what's happening here. And that Cain and Abel are twins supports a narrative analogy between Genesis 3 here and later twins, Esau and Jacob, who again have strife between them, as we will see, and similar their stories are told in similar ways. We ask now, what's in a name? The first son is named Cain, which sounds in Hebrew like the word forgotten. I have gotten a man. It's not an etymology, but it's a play on words. I've gotten a man, and so I name him something that sounds like gotten. Eve's statement is exceedingly short in Hebrew and can be read equally plausibly in three different ways. And so this is the first of these open ambiguities that we just don't quite know what to make of. She could be saying, I have made a man just like Yahweh has. In this case, it would be an expression of hubris, of pride. I'm on same grounds as God. He made a man, Adam, and now I've made a man, Cain. It could mean I have gotten a man with God's help. In this case, it would be a faithful expression of humility. This is not in my own power, but it is only through God's power that I have borne a son. The third possibility, and again, the translations are equally plausible because the Hebrew is so, it's only three words here, and it's difficult to know what to make of them. The third possibility is that Eve could in fact be saying, I have a man, namely Yahweh, that she thinks somehow this might even be the incarnate God, or at least the man who Yahweh promised in 3:15, that there would be this seed who would destroy the serpent. This would be Luther's preferred view. In this case, you would be putting the hopes that were promised in 3:15, you will have a child who will fight against the serpent. She would be putting all those hopes on Cain, saying, here is that child that was promised. Again, all three of these are plausible renderings of the Hebrew, and so we have to keep it as open options as we read the story and think, what makes the best sense in the way the narrative progresses? While she gives this explanation for Cain's name, there is no explanation given for Abel's name. This in itself might even suggest that Eve's hopes have in fact been placed on Cain. Here's the son. This is the one who's going to defeat the serpent. Don't worry about this other kid. He's just an extra, a backup, or something along those lines. And this, that Abel might be an afterthought, is actually supported by his name. His name means breath or vapor or vanity. It's that word that's repeated throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. It's just something briefly passing, as in fact we see Abel is a briefly passing person. So there's something going on even in the names here, that Eve seems to have set a lot of hopes on Cain, and yet Abel is this afterthought almost. Next, we find out about their careers. Abel is a herdsman. Cain works the ground. Both of these seem to be evocative jobs that they have. Abel being a herdsman or a shepherd perhaps reminds us of King David, who is also a prominent shepherd, of Abraham with his large flock. So it kind of foreshadows other prominent figures that are coming later in the story. Cain's vocation, on the other hand, looks backwards. The job that he has working the ground is precisely the language of Genesis 2:15. God created the man and put him in the garden in order to work the ground. Cain, as it were, takes up the family business while Abel goes out to make his money in the world elsewhere. So we have two characters, Cain and Abel. They have two different jobs, different names. We read next, in the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. Again, a number of questions face us as readers. First would be, where did Cain and Abel, at any rate, even get the idea that they should be making offerings or sacrifices? Admittedly, this question may not have been as pressing to an ancient Israelite reader or hearer of this story. After all, offerings were a known part of all religious cultures, both in Israel and roundabout. So it could just be the assumption of early readers that this is simply what you do, is give offerings to the gods. It does not, however, mean delegitimize the interpretive question, where did they get this idea from? Is sacrifice and offering here a human innovation, or is it somehow a command by God? Is the rule of sacrifice perhaps implicit in God's covering of Adam and Eve with garments of skin that we read in the previous chapter? Implicitly, God would have had to kill an animal in order to get these garments of skin to clothe Adam and Eve. So perhaps that's where the idea comes from, is just as God had to make this sacrifice to cover Adam and Eve, so we should sacrifice from our flocks. What is clear from the story before us is that Cain brings an offering first, and Abel also does. Abel follows Big Brother. It's Cain who's leading the religious activity here. The second question that faces us is, should we rationalize or not rationalize? Should we try to understand why one offering is preferred and not the other? Is there a reason open to us as readers for why God prefers Abel and his offering to Cain and his offering? Don't get me wrong, undoubtedly God has his own reasons. The question is, are these reasons available to us? And it seems to me that they don't appear available on the text in front of us. An ancient tradition going all the way back to the Septuagint, that Greek translation of the Bible, is a suggestion that Cain made a misstep in the way that he offered his offering. He didn't divide it correctly. Somehow he messed up in making his offering, and that's why it was rejected. So in the Septuagint, it's, if you divide the offering rightly, then it will go rightly for you. The Hebrew of 4 verse 7, where God does speak to Cain, is admittedly difficult, but this really isn't a justified translation. Rather, it's a sort of interpretive filling in of the gaps to try and make sense of the story. So it's a possibility that Cain messed up offering the sacrifice, but certainly the text before us doesn't lead us to think that that's necessarily the issue. A more recent argument that's popular in some Christian circles is that the problem with Cain's offering is that it does not involve a blood sacrifice, that he brings fruit of the ground, vegetables, whereas Abel brings a animal as a sacrifice. This too, it seems to me, is implausible. Although the shedding of blood is implicit in God's covering of Adam and Eve with garments of skin, the actual term blood has not yet been used in the Genesis narrative. And so it's not even a topic on the horizon of does blood need to be shed or not shed. Moreover, the grain offering is an important part of the Levitical sacrifice system in the book of Leviticus. So both sacrifice or offerings given in verses 3 and 4 are offerings named in the book of Leviticus as offerings that should be given on a regular basis. So nothing in the terminology itself makes us think one was better than the other. I know that you've probably heard some fairly bro-y sermons about how God likes steak and not vegetables, and that explains all this. But it's simply unfounded in the text. A third possibility that seems to me the most likely is that there might be an implied contrast between the specification that Abel brought not only some of his sheep, but that he brought specifically the fat portions from the firstlings. And this is implicitly perhaps contrasted with the rather generic offering of fruit from the ground that Cain brought. This rationalization of God's preference for Abel's offering over Cain's is indeed rooted in the text, but it still seems tenuous at best. It's at most an implied contrast, an argument from silence, that it doesn't say, that Cain brought the best vegetables or something like that. But even in the nature of the case, what sort of thing might it specify further about Cain's offering? I mean, is there a best part to a cucumber, or is some portion of the wheat better than another that it should specify that he brought? It seems to me in the nature of the case, you're offering fruit of the ground, it's fruit of the ground. There's really not that big of a difference between one end of a cucumber and the other, as opposed to the fat portion and more lean portions of a cut of meat. Rabbinic sources here imagine that perhaps Cain only brought the chaff from the wheat rather than the kernel. And again, this is a sort of an imaginative engagement with the text, but it certainly goes well beyond the words in front of us, which I'm trying to stick to here. What do we do then? I want to suggest here that we actually get more mileage if we resist the urge to offer some sort of a rationalization, that is like a hard and fast reason, this is what Cain did wrong and therefore he was rejected, and instead consider further the narrative analogy between Jacob and Esau and Cain and Abel. Recall the story of Jacob and Esau that comes later in Genesis. Their twin brothers are also characterized by broadly divergent vocations. Esau is a great huntsman, while his brother Jacob tends more to domestic affairs. There, Esau is preferred by his father, while Jacob is preferred by the mother. Perhaps this finds an analogy in Eve's careful naming of one son and virtual ignoring of the other son. What is significant in the Jacob and Esau story, though, is that God, we are told, favors one sibling over the other from the womb. From the very beginning, he's picked one son to use rather than the other. And this, of course, precludes any possible rationalization for God's choice from a human perspective. Surely God has his reasons for why he used Jacob rather than Esau in the way that he did. But from our point of view, two children in the womb are there's no difference between them. It's hard to pick one to be the captain of the basketball team and not the other, right? We do need to be careful here, though. If we call this election, which we could rightly call it if we use this term, we need to be careful and recognize, though, that this is not election to eternal salvation or perdition, as if Esau is damned from birth and Jacob on the road to heaven from birth. But rather, it's an election to a specific role within the divine economy. With this plan to unfold God's kingdom in the earth, Jacob would be used as the chosen line rather than Esau. Thus, Esau is not damned from the womb, but rather God has chosen Jacob, the younger, unfavored by his father, as the son that he would work with to bring about this ultimately promised seed. And we see this theme running throughout the book of Genesis. It's Isaac, not Ishmael. It's Jacob, not Esau. It ends up being Judah, not any of his 11 brothers. So there seems to be, and there's, I won't belabor the point, but there's lots of reasons to think that these two stories are told in terms that echo each other. The Jacob and Esau story on the one hand and Cain and Abel on the other. Considering these stories together then, the stories of Cain and Abel and Jacob and Esau, and the stories that seem written intentionally to echo each other, it leads us to reflect on those inequalities that are fundamental to the human condition. Many factors of human life are unequally distributed among people without regard to merit. This is just a fact of life. Many of these things that are oftentimes the things that we are the very most proud of, or conversely the most ashamed of, have been substantially determined from the womb, irrespective of preference or deserving. Things like beauty or our physique are largely determined by our genes, not by anything we do in this world or merit. Natural intelligence. Certainly there's ways to cultivate our physique and our intelligence, but there is a measure of natural intelligence that is given unequally to various human beings. Similarly, being born to a rich family or a poor family, a family in social good standing or social bad standing, it's all outside of our control. Reflecting on this yesterday, I ran a half marathon with my dad, and there was people who trained much harder than me that finished after me. There was people that trained not as much as me and finished before me, because in the nature of the case, we have different legs and different muscles and different bodies, and they go at different speeds is the bottom line. And so the question is, what can we do with what we're given, not sitting there in a race complaining about how someone else has a longer stride than I do or something like that. Similarly, not only are there various things from birth, but there's various things that happen in the subsequent courses of our life that, again, are unequally distributed. Consider, for example, how often you've probably seen this, that you could think of two relatively equally qualified persons, and one finds work easily, while the other person winds up on unemployment, perhaps even for years, trying to find a job. Or we probably all know people who are meticulous about caring for themselves and yet are stricken with grave illness. Or conversely, at least I know people who subsist apparently entirely on diets of cigarettes and alcohol and yet live well into their old age. I'm not saying that life is fundamentally absurd or random. Broad trends tell us exercise and health tend to go together. Stress and heart disease tend to go together. There's various behaviors that generally have these various effects. But nevertheless, it is a fundamental fact of human life that there are factors basic to our existence in this world, to the human condition, that are unequally distributed from birth, and that various tragic things happen, even to the most undeserving, while, as Jeremiah laments, the wicked prosper. There is fundamental inequality in human existence, and it's just a fact of life. What are our possible responses to this situation, then? One response is to accept that this is the way it is. Things are unequal. Another response is to blame luck or fate. You can think of the common English phrase, curse my luck, or someone curses their luck, right? That this idea that somehow something outside their control is dictating their destiny, and that's what's to blame for these bad things that have happened. A third group, or a third option, is not to blame luck or fate, but rather to blame God himself, that God is doing this to me, and to be angry at God. In this story of Cain and Abel, given the context of is offering up various offerings in a context of worship, we are drawn explicitly into this mindset of blaming God. Why has God not regarded my offering? Cain asks himself. So to summarize, my suggestion is that rather than trying to say he did this wrong or that wrong, and this is the reason God preferred one offering to another, that rather this is just one of those things that we from the human side of things don't fully understand, that it's an unequal distribution, that God preferred one offering and not the other. The real question, and this seems to be, to me, to be the question that the text also chases up, is what do we do about it? Not why did this happen, but what do we do moving forward? In Cain's case, this leads to resentment and anger. We're told Cain was very angry and his face fell. This inequality is not just an inequality, but it's fundamentally an injustice that must be railed against. This built-up resentment towards God and towards his brother, whose offering was regarded by God, builds up and it festers, leading to sin, and in Cain's case, ultimately to murder. The question then is fundamentally, will you let perceived injustice destroy you? This question runs throughout the Old Testament. Think of Jeremiah's lament in Jeremiah chapter 12 that I just referenced, or perhaps God's question to Jonah. Jonah is upset that God extends grace to Nineveh, the worst city of his day, and God asks, do you do well to be angry? That from Jonah's point of view, it says, these guys are awful, you should wipe them out, and yet God extends grace to them, and to Jonah this seems fundamentally unfair. So it's a prominent theme throughout the Old Testament. How do we handle these sorts of unequal distributions in our life? Here is where the narrative analogy with Esau and Jacob throws a sharp contrast on our story. Esau was not chosen from birth, but moreover, he was swindled out of his inheritance by his brother, Jacob, who was God's chosen from birth. Esau, as a result, flies into a murderous rage, just like Cain. It's a serious enough rage, and he's serious enough about killing his brother, that Jacob actually flees out of the country for many years. When Jacob eventually returns, he still is worried that the fallout is going to be murder, that Esau might still be wanting to kill him all these years later. And yet, if you recall what happens, though Jacob is worried Esau is going to try and kill him, in fact, Esau comes and falls on his knees before him and cries and reconciles himself to Jacob. Esau then, though he gets a bad rap in Christian tradition, really is a model for our reaction to providence. God said, I'm going to use Jacob's line rather than Esau's to do these things I want to do to bring about the nation of Israel. And Esau ultimately, though at first he's upset about it, he ultimately reconciles himself to that. And he says, I'm going to be reconciled to my brother Jacob, and it's through his line that ultimately our salvation is going to come. And so he, we could say, yields to providence rather than being angry against it. With that background in mind, then, let's turn and see where Cain goes instead. In 4:6-7, the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Returning then to our story, although Cain's offering was not regarded by God, interestingly, it is Cain who God speaks to, not Abel. Not having his offering regarded by God doesn't mean he's simply been cut off or ignored by God, but God still very much wants to have something to do with him. He wants to have a real relationship. He's talking to him about these things. It's not a wholesale rejection of Cain, but rather he's faced with this sort of simple, not this, but that option. And the question then is, can he subdue his pride and self-will to obey God, or will he let pride and self-will rule? We pick up here then our second theme, the growth of sin. As I suggested earlier, there's broad analogies or a shared structure of these four episodes in Genesis 3 through 11, where a divine command is given, humans rebel against it, God judges them for it, but there is grace given. So with that broad structure in mind, we're already thinking this story should be compared to Genesis 3. And in fact, in the next several verses, when God questions Cain about his brother, the questions are largely similar to the ones that he asks Adam and Eve. Where are you? What have you done? In this case, where is your brother? What have you done? So asking these similar questions. Again, as we've noted, Cain's birth is framed as God's blessing of a seed, as promised in Genesis 3. Cain's vocation is a continuation of the command given to Adam previously. There's lots of reasons to think that in some ways Genesis 4 is a almost a restatement or a reworking of Genesis 3. And it's important to notice this for this reason, because there is one sharp divergence between Genesis 3 and Genesis 4. Here in Genesis 4:7, God reworks his words to Eve. He told Eve, your desire will be for your husband, but he will rule over you. And he now says, your desire is for, or sorry, rather, sin's desire is for you, but you must rule over it. So keeping these broadly similar structures in mind, pay attention to this. In Genesis 3, Eve is tempted by a serpent, an outside objective temptation that persuades her to eat the fruit. In Genesis 4, though, there is no external temptation. Rather, sin is described as being like a wild animal. It's crouching at the door. Therefore, it's like a wild animal. It takes the place of the serpent in Genesis 3. But it's not outside. It's not around the corner. It's not hanging in the tree tempting Eve. But rather, it's inside of Cain. It's crouching at the door of his heart. Its desire is to rule over him, but he must try and rule over it. The temptation to sin, then, is now something internal to humans rather than external. Moreover, not only is Cain not faced by some sort of a serpent tempting him, but God is actively trying to persuade Cain to resist temptation, to not do wrong. This now then is the human condition. We do not need anyone to try and convince us to do wrong things. It's not like we are just living, you know, perfect lives at home when we're by ourselves, and then as soon as someone comes along and tempts us, that's when sin starts, right? And I think you know full well that on your own, you can be lazy, you can waste your time, you can do things you ought not to do, that you know that the temptation is within you to do wrong. Moreover, this sin crouches at the door. This anger and this sense that things are wrong festers in Cain, and it leads to this murderous resentment. There's something important to note here. Cain is not depicted as some sort of a flagrant sinner. Up to this point, we're not told that he's womanizing and drinking and you know, smashing people over the head with beer bottles and just this like horrible person who then ultimately murders his brother. Rather, Cain follows the vocation given to Adam. He's doing what humans ought to do. Moreover, he's the first to bring an offering to God. He leads the family in worship. Thus, it's in the very context of worship that Cain's anger towards God and his brother develops and leads towards murder. That is to say, this isn't some guy down the street at the bar that kills his brother. This is someone here sitting in the pew, someone who goes to church as they should, who's apparently living rightly. And yet, even in that context, resentment and anger can fester in our hearts and lead to sin. So God tells, he warns Abel, basically, in strong terms. He says, do well and you'll be accepted, but if not, sin is crouching at the door. What happens then? Well, we're told Cain speaks to his brother Abel, and they were in the field. Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. And the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. Again, the question of what was said by Cain to Abel is open and perhaps, in the nature of the case, unresolvable. Perhaps he said something as simple as, let's go out to the field. But maybe he acted as if everything's okay. He's happy with, you know, he's not upset with Abel. And then in the course of their life, they were out in the field and he smacks him over the head with a rock or however he rises up and kills him. But again, this story's open to multiple construals. What is stressed here in these three verses is six times the phrase your or his brother is used. Abel, almost every time, his name is never just used just Abel, but it's always Abel, your brother, Abel, his brother, your brother, where is your brother? What did he do to his brother? The emphasis is on not only is this a sin, but it's a gross violation of social and family bonds. It's not just someone that he had to kill out in the field because they got into a fight or something like that, but this is his brother who he grew up with, who he, you know, especially if they were twins, from the very crib would have been together. The emphasis is on this violation of social bonds. Again, it picks up themes from Genesis 3. There, Adam shifts the blame from himself to his wife. Here, Cain refuses correction by God and instead murders his brother. So in both cases, we see family bonds being dissolved. The interrogation by God echoes Genesis 3. He asks, where is your brother? Just as he asked Adam, where are you? There, Adam answered honestly, even if he does diffuse the blame. Here, Cain flatly lies to God, saying he doesn't know, and then responds with this question, am I my brother's keeper, which at any rate seems to me very petulant, this sort of flippant response, especially after just killing your brother. After the second question then, what have you done, God doesn't even wait for a response. Cain's lying and just being rude in response rather than somehow trying to be honest or showing any remorse at his own actions. So God then just proceeds to say, you are now cursed. He points to Abel's blood as a witness against Cain. The punishment strikes again, just as in Adam and Eve, it struck at their vocation. It again strikes directly at Cain's vocation. The ground has been watered with your brother's blood, and now no longer will it yield forth fruit when you try to work it. Cain then is cursed to be a vagabond and wanderer on the earth. As a tiller of soil, he was fixed in his fields while Abel, when he was a tiller of soil before he kills Abel, before he's cursed, while Abel wandered about with his flock. So he's fixed in a certain location. Now Cain is dislocated. He's set to wander about. Cain then responds in 4:13 and following. He says, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken upon him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attempt to attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod to the east of Eden. Cain's response, again, like as we've seen many of the key phrases, can be read in two different ways. The term for punishment in Hebrew means both guilt and punishment, because the two concepts are intrinsically related in the Hebrew mindset. And so this path, his response to God could be read in two different ways. It could be read, "My punishment is too much for me," this sort of complaint about God punishing him, which in my mind, being sent to wander for killing your brother, is, if anything, too light of a punishment rather than too harsh. But it seems that that's one option. The other option is Cain could actually be saying, "My guilt is too great to be borne away," as if he's saying, "My sin is too great, it cannot be forgiven." So again, there's this openness to two different options. I want to pause here and just reflect for a moment on these various openness and ambiguity in our story. After all, the Bible is full of these sorts of things, and so it raises the question, does this mean that our Bible is somehow faulty or flawed? Couldn't God have given us a better book that was more specific, perhaps? And the answer is no. This is the sort of book that we ought to have. A more specific book would look more like an encyclopedia, which is something no one ever really reads, right? This is a story. And the way that stories work is they have these gaps that need to be filled in by the readers, and it draws us into the story itself. So the ambiguity means that the story is intrinsically open, but it's also a strength. It draws us, ourselves, into the text. And so we see here in this case, though his response to God could be read in two ways, since he proceeds to explain that his real fear is that he will be killed by someone else, it seems more likely that he's objecting to the punishment rather than to his guilt. The essence of the complaint, then, is the fear of being killed. And here another question is raised. Who is it that might kill Cain? Are these other people coming from? Is he thinking of Adam and Eve? Certainly the way he phrases it sounds like while he's wandering about, he's going to encounter other people and they'll try to kill him. Again, there's been two possible answers proposed throughout the history of reading the Bible. That is, in the thousands of years people have been doing this. One way is to suggest that the other people he's afraid of are other descendants of Adam and Eve, in which case they would actually be relatives of Abel who was murdered, and even more likely to try and kill Cain. The other option is just that the narrative seems to presuppose there's other people that we haven't yet been told about. And this does kind of fit with the genre of it being a genealogy, because genealogies focus on a specific line and don't really address the question of what's happening in other families. Either way, the narrative seems to presuppose something it doesn't tell us directly about. Either Adam and Eve have other children that we don't yet know about, or there's other people round about that we don't yet know about. Again, this is just a function of Hebrew narratives. They're very selective. They don't tell us a lot of details. When you sit down to read Pride and Prejudice, for example, right? You know what Mr. Darcy looks like. You know what all the characters look like, what each of the sisters looks like. It's part of the way they tell the story. When we're reading this, we don't know what Adam looked like. We don't know what Eve looked like. We don't know what Cain looked like. We don't know what Abel looked like. It's just irrelevant. They only tell us details that are absolutely fundamental to the narrative, which can be frustrating to us because in our culture, right, we're used to watching movies or reading books that describe everything, and we want to know these sorts of details. But at any rate, God's response in 4:15 and 16 is to bind himself to Cain and to pledge himself to be Cain's blood redeemer. That he says, if someone kills you, I will take on the role of avenging your death. Again, this is a very striking thing. God has not favored Cain's offering. Cain has committed murder against his brother and is cursed because of it. And yet God is not done with him. He's still willing to engage with Cain, even to the point of binding himself to avenging Cain's death. The question then comes, what is this mark that God puts on Cain? Is it some sort of a tribal face tattoo like Mike Tyson that everyone who sees him will be afraid of? What is this mark? I think probably the mark is this oath that God has put on Cain itself, that it's a metaphorical mark rather than something physical. But if there were some sort of a physical indicator that this is a protected person, that would fit with broadly with the terms of the narrative. But again, we're not told exactly what this mark looked like. To much consternation, as people have tried to discover the mark of Cain throughout history, right? He sets off to wander in the land of Nod. This term Nod simply means wandering in Hebrew, so he just wanders about in the wilderness, or the land of wandering. At this point, then, this first narrative expansion ends, and we pick back up with the genealogy. We're told that Cain knew his wife. She conceived and bore Enoch. When he built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. They have various other sons, leading to the seventh in the line, whose name is Lamech. And Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of one was Adah, the name of the other Zillah. Adah bore Jabal, the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. And then Zillah bore Tubal-Cain, who was the forger of instruments of bronze and iron. And his sister was Naamah. Again here with this genealogy, when we resume with the genealogy that's the frame for the whole scenario that we've just read, it again raises this twofold question of both the growth of sin on the one hand and God's providence on the other. Though God sends Cain to wander about, we see right away Cain does not wander about. Instead, he founds a city, right? So again, he's already disobeying what he was sent to do. But cities aren't intrinsically bad things. They have walls, they have a watchtower, they mean we're protected from wild animals. And so overall we would say this is a good innovation, even if this good innovation comes from the first murderer. So there's this interesting dynamic here where he's both deeply marred by sin and yet does something that ultimately is good for humans. Similarly, we get this guy at Lamech at the end who really is one of the most unlikable characters in the entire Bible. His claim to fame is inventing bigamy. He brings these two wives rather than one. He's immediately treating them as chattel. And he stands here and he says, Adah and Zillah, my wives, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. Hear me now, wives. If your husband is walking around the house saying, wife of Scott, I'll pick on you, Scott. wife of Scott, hear what I say. Please talk to one of the elders or pastor after service. Like, this is not a healthy situation that's being described here. This guy is just sort of this belligerent pig that's marching around, beating his chest. He calls his wife to come listen to him, and what he says to him is, I killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. So Cain's upset, and he kills someone. Lamech's saying, if someone even bumps into me at the grocery store, that guy's dead. Like, I just fly off the handle. And he says, Cain's revenge is sevenfold, Lamech's is 77-fold. But remember, Cain's revenge was not revenge. It was God's promise to avenge. That is, God would take justice into his hands if someone killed Cain. And yet Lamech's saying, mine is a revenge, that I will do it myself. I will kill, if someone kills me, I guess I'll kill them 77 times, which the logic of the story doesn't even make sense, right? That if he's dead, he's dead. I don't know how he's going to avenge himself 77 times. But he's just this sort of arrogant, the things that are problematic in Cain are here 77-fold represented in Lamech. So this genealogy, it begins and ends with these problematic things of Cain not wandering but building a city, Lamech being this vengeful, wicked guy. And yet in the midst of it, not only do we see the city, which is a good thing, but we see these various technical innovations. We see the invention of musical instruments. We see the development of these bronze and iron tools. And we see dwelling in tents and having livestock, this sort of nomadic lifestyle being developed. And what's interesting is that none of these technologies are intrinsically bad. David plays these musical instruments in order to worship the Lord. Abraham dwells in tents and has livestock. Certainly everybody in the biblical world uses bronze and iron instruments. So they're not intrinsically bad things. So what we see is this interesting dynamic where there's both profound technological innovation and profound moral failure overlapping at the same time. This then seems to reflect deeply our own situation that we find ourselves in. Our own society, we could say, is marked by very profound technical innovations, that our technology is far beyond anything that previous generations have ever seen or civilizations have ever experienced. And yet at the same time, we could say that our society is marked by profound moral failures and I would even argue a fundamental inability to answer the question of what technology is for or why we even have these things. And I pause on this for a moment because I know many of you work in tech jobs, that you work with computers, with programming, that part of your work is to develop these sorts of technical innovations. And certainly all of our lives are conditioned by these sorts of technological advances. And so we have to ask, what sense do we make of these sorts of careers and of the society that we live in that's very technologically advanced, given this text? And what we would say is that we need to recognize that technological advance in and of itself is not a savior, and it is not progress in and of itself that's somehow going to deliver us, but that you have this ambiguous framing of this moral faults of Cain and Lamech at the beginning and end. And so like this text open to multiple construals, the technology that's developed is, again, open to multiple uses, some good and some bad. I guess I'll leave off from there, but it does seem to me that this merits some reflection, especially for those of us who are working in technical sort of jobs, developing these sorts of innovations. We'll leave it at that. The final part of the story then picks up a different genealogy. It goes back to Adam, and it says in verses 25 and following that Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth, for she said, God has appointed for me another offspring, or literally another seed, instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. At that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord. So now we see two parallel lines. One is the line going from Adam through Cain, and it culminates in the seventh generation with Lamech, and the seventh marks this sort of fruition or this fullness that this line has come to fruition in this vengeful guy, Lamech. On the other hand, we have a second line that comes from Adam, and it goes through Seth. At this point, we're only told about Enosh. In chapter 5 that we'll pick up in the new year, we'll read the rest of this genealogy of Seth as it continues there. A few comments here then. Adam knew his wife again. She bore a son and called his name Seth, for she said, God has appointed for me another offspring, or literally another seed. That the language here, it seems to me to be explicitly reflecting back on 3:15, where God promised that you will have a seed who will fight against the serpent, that you have this promised seed that you're looking forward to. And if Eve thought it was Cain, she now recognizes it's not. And instead she says, I have a new seed in the place of Abel, who was killed. So we see then Eve placing hope in what we could call providence, that even though this absurd evil has happened in her family, that one of her sons has killed another, which we could pause and reflect for a moment, as bad as it would be losing a child, how much worse one of your children murdering the other, that it's just this almost brings you to the point where you wouldn't want to risk having more kids because they seem to be so profoundly uncontrollable. And yet she does have another son, and in that circumstance, not only does she have another son, she doesn't name him Abel again, breath, vapor, passing away, you know, that somehow it's futile to have more children, but she names him Seth, explicitly saying it's because I'm putting my hope that God will still bring his promises to fruition. There will be a seed eventually through this line that will bring about salvation. We then find an analogy for our own position in that of Eve's. That we too are in a situation where we look about and we don't understand the circumstances that we are faced with often. Things happen in our lives that we don't necessarily understand the reasons for. As I suggested, some of us, you know, there's a fundamentally unequal distribution of human characteristics amongst us. Some of us are faster than others. Some of us are smarter than others. Some of us are richer than others. And many of these things are outside of our control. So we're faced with a situation where we, like Cain, ask, why have things been unequally distributed? Is this fair, or is this a fundamental injustice? And like Cain, this sense of injustice at the way things have happened in our lives, the way situation we've been born into, the things that have happened to us, it will readily lead to resentment if we are not careful. We, like Cain, are faced with God's warning that if you do well, it will go well with you, but sin is crouching at the door, anger and resentment. You don't have to work hard to become angry or resentful at the circumstances that happen in your life. It's the natural tendency of the human heart that when things happen to us, we become angry, we become resentful. And so we, like Cain, are faced with this position of needing to guard against resentment and these sorts of things. But we're also like Eve, that we want to look on these circumstances and say, there has been an unequal distribution. Things have not gone as I would have planned them or even as I believe they were merited. Eve could say, I didn't deserve for one of my sons to kill the other. And yet she has hope in this circumstance. She says, yet I believe that God is doing something, that there is a plan at work, even if I don't understand it. And this is our own situation. We would say there is a plan at work, what we call in theological terms providence, that something is happening in the world, that God is telling a story through reality. And yet we don't stand at the end of this story. We don't know the conclusion. We know indications of what the conclusion will be, just as Eve had the promise of God of the future coming seed. And yet we're not at the end of the book looking backwards. We're not at the end of the movie saying everything has turned out right in the end. To think of the Lord of the Rings. I mean, they get back to the Shire at the end, right? But where we at is oftentimes on the slopes of the mountains, Mount Doom getting into Mordor. To us, it looks like a desperate situation. And this is the fact of the matter, is that oftentimes we look at our life and we don't understand what's happening. Affirming providence, then, that God is telling a story through the world, that he does have a plan for the world. Affirming providence, then, is more like learning a spiritual discipline than verifying a scientific hypothesis. It's not that we sit down and look at everything and say, well, the earth is exact number of miles from the sun, therefore human life is here, therefore providence is a true theological doctrine. Rather, we have to say, it's an assertion of faith, it's an assertion of hope, that we're saying, even if I don't fundamentally understand what's going on in my life, I know that there is a plan and that there is an overarching story that makes sense of this. We ask them, what is the basis for our hope? Eve's basis was this promise that there would be a seed. What is the basis for our hope? Well, we don't know the end of the story, but we do know the center of the story. We know who the main character is now. He's entered the stage. I pick up here Hebrews chapter 12 at verse 22. The writer of Hebrews encourages us, saying, you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and the innumerable angels in festal gatherings, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirit of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. The author of Hebrews here reflects on the very story that we have been reflecting on this morning. The reason for hope he gives is not simply blind hope or trust that things will turn out right in the end, that we sort of naively think, well, everything's going to happen for the best eventually. But rather the basis for our hope is to see that in the man Jesus, God himself has entered the story. Not only has God himself entered the story, but he didn't ride about like a Caesar on some sort of a victory parade, just from triumph to triumph, from glory to glory, but rather he entered the world in an ignoble manner, that he entered the world in a baby in a manger, as we sung, in the most far-flung corner of the Roman Empire, in this very humble circumstances, and things didn't get better from there. He was a famous preacher for about a year, but then his people decided they wanted to kill him, and then they ultimately did kill him. And so we see things that from the outside, from a merely human point of view, we'd say there's something just fundamentally absurd about this. Nothing Jesus taught, in our opinion, would be so offensive as to merit murder, perhaps. And yet here he is being unjustly executed. And so we see something that from a merely human perspective, we don't know how to make sense of it. But we are told that it is in this very event that we have difficulty reconciling merely as humans that the turning point of the story has happened, that things move now from, that the basis for our hope has been established, that we have this new covenant and we have a mediator. We're told that his blood speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. As we read in Genesis 4, the blood of Abel cries out, declaring the guilt of Cain. And yet Jesus' blood does not cry out declaring our guilt, but rather it cries out declaring our innocence. It says that our sinfulness has been punished, that the guilt has been taken away, and that now, in his blood, we can be presented into this throne room, this heavenly city that's described here. And so our hope is not the city that Cain established and named for his son, but rather our hope is this heavenly Jerusalem, as we're told here in this passage, the city of the living God. So we are like Eve, that we are faced with circumstances in our life that we don't know how to make sense of, and you may be here this morning, or rather afternoon, I don't really know what time of day it is at this point. It's so dark during the winter. But at this time of day, we're here. You may be saying to yourself, you know, I just can't make sense of what's happening in my life. And you may even, if you honestly reflect on what's going on, sense resentments that are building up not only towards God, but towards various family members perhaps, coworkers, people who we would identify as being analogous to brothers that are constantly in our lives. And we do have resentment that builds up towards it. And yet, at the same time, we are not stuck in Cain's situation where he is just left to master evil on his own, but rather, we have a reason for hope, that we see that there is a reason for believing in providence, because the central character of this story that God is telling has come, has died on our behalf, has paid the punishment. Cain says, it's too great of a punishment for me to bear. Well, certainly it is too great of a punishment for any of us to bear, and yet it has been borne in the man Jesus, and as a result, now his blood cries out, not guilt, but mercy. So this is the situation then that we are all faced with. You may not yet identify as a Christian, you might not yet say that Christ is your mediator. You might be stuck in the situation of Cain, just saying, my punishment is too great to bear. I would say to you today that there is grace being offered, that this punishment has been borne, that there is blood crying out for mercy, and that is what we come forward to celebrate as we come to the Lord's table, those who are Christians and have been baptized into this body, that we would say it is through his blood that we have life, and so that's why we drink the wine together. So this might be one situation you're in which case I would say come forward after the service. Brant will invite you to again, but come forward after the service and let us explain to you more clearly this gospel message, that there is hope, that we are not stuck in this situation of Cain with a punishment too great to bear, but has been borne on our behalf. On the other hand, you might say, you know, that's good. I know that's true, but it still is a struggle for you today to say, are things going to turn out for the best? Why are these things happening to me? And I look out at Chris sitting in front of me, and you think, why is Elliot going through these things she's going through? And it's, we can't put away the reality of trying circumstances in each of our lives. And there we, once again, have to return to our hope that we have a firm foundation for our hope, that Christ has entered the world, that he is putting things to right. But like the Old Testament saints, we are still in a position of longing for things to be put ultimately right, for everything to ultimately be fixed. So that is what we do during this Advent season. We remember that this is not the final destination, but there is still a greater thing coming, that this heavenly Jerusalem and this reinstatement of order and justice in our world. So these seem to me to be the two applications this morning, either to find your mediator in Christ or to find your hope not in this world but in the next, that you would embrace this Advent season of longing. With those applications in mind, let us turn now to prayer before we turn to the Lord's table. Father, we acknowledge that in our life, so often we are faced by circumstances and events that seem to be to us fundamentally unfair. They seem to be unequal and even unjust. And we too readily allow this to fester into resentment and anger. We too readily allow this even to lead to sin, to the point of murderous rage at the circumstances that we are faced with. We see at the same time, Lord, that this is not the way that we ultimately want to live. And so we ask that you would shape our desires and our longing as we reflect this Advent season, that you would teach us to long not for Cain and his city of Enoch, but rather for the heavenly Jerusalem, this true city whose builder is God, not man. So I ask this morning that as your Spirit is at work in each of us, that you would help us to long rightly rather than wrongly, that you would help us to have our desires shaped, that as we turn to the table, we would return once again to our reason for our hope, that we would find once again a foundation for our hope in the work that your Son has done on our behalf. I ask these things through your Son, the mediator whose blood cries mercy, by the power of your Spirit. Amen.